Hello, and welcome to this special episode of The Peace Frequency. I am your host, Darren Cambridge. The Peace Frequency is a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from across the globe to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. The Peace Frequency is brought to you by the United States Institute of Peace Global Campus, preparing individuals around the world through online learning to prevent and transform violent conflict. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Sitting next to me in the studio is Dr. Allison Milofsky. She's been co-hosting this podcast with me during the month of January, as this is the month that we are offering her course called Community-Based Peacebuilding, Engaging Youth. So Allison, it's good to have you co-hosting the show with me again today.
And as always, I'm happy to be here.
And can you tell our listeners and our guests, who I will introduce in a little bit, can you tell them a little bit about what is this community-based peacebuilding course about?
Sure. The course really explores strategies for engaging young people in conversations about peace and conflict. And it's based around our toolkits, our peacebuilding toolkits for educators. And there are really three themes that we're exploring this month. The first is that conflict is an inherent part of the human condition. The second is that violent conflict can be prevented. And the third is that there are many ways to be a peace builder.
Awesome. Thank you, Allison. And like I said, this is a special episode of Peace Frequency. We normally broadcast live on Tuesdays, but something special is happening here in the United States. This past Monday, we celebrated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And the nation and the world, in large part, reflected on his legacy as a voice for nonviolence, and as a civil rights leader who fought against racism, militarism, and poverty. So in honor of MLK and to continue the conversation beyond the holiday, today's show is dedicated to the history, theory, and practice of nonviolence, or what others may call civil resistance, direct action, people power, or satyagraha. So what role is nonviolence playing in today's conflicts? How have communities that are engaged in conflict, that are facing injustice, or are living under oppressive conditions, applying nonviolence in their struggles? And what are specific ways to teach and train communities, particularly youth, to understand nonviolent struggle and wage it successfully? Helping us explore these questions, we are joined today on the show by four outstanding nonviolent scholars, educators, and activists. And I'm going to introduce them to you right now, each one at a time. And as I share their amazing backgrounds, I want them to think about this question, because I'm going to ask you to respond to it after I'm done introducing you. And that question is, what are three words that capture what you understand nonviolence to be? What are three words that capture what you understand nonviolence to be? So first off, we are joined by Elavi Endura. Elavi is a professor of education at the George Mason University's College of Education and Human Development. She is author and co-editor of many books, including The Power of Nonviolence: Peace, Politics, and Practice for the 21st Century and Beyond. Elavi was a 2010-2011 fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and the recipient of the Peace and Justice Studies Association's 2011 Peace Educator of the Year Award. Elavi, thank you for being with us on the show today.
You're very welcome.
So Elavi, the question is put to you. What are three words that capture what you understand nonviolence to be?
Well, my three words are, first of all, love. And my second is social responsibility. And my third is interdependence.
Okay, love, social responsibility, and interdependence. Okay, let me see if I can lock those in. We're going to come back to that. Next, we have Arthur Romano. Arthur is an assistant professor also at George Mason University in their School for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. He is a scholar practitioner whose research and applied interests include global educational movements, the use of transformative and experiential education in communities that are affected by violence, and nonviolence education. Arthur has designed and implemented educational programs in Asia, Africa, and Central America on peace and conflict resolution related themes. He co-developed the Diversity Matters Now workshop series, which explores issues related to identity and peace building in colleges and universities across the United States. Arthur, my brother, good to have you on the show.
Glad to be here.
And question goes to you, Arthur. What are three words that capture what you understand nonviolence to be?
A creative force that's accessible and participatory. I had to use some nonviolent resistance there and include one more word.
You did, a little civil disobedience there. So a creative force that, say that again.
Creative force that's accessible.
A creative force that is accessible.
And participatory.
And participatory. Okay, great. Yes, Allison's writing notes, so I appreciate that. That's good. Okay, thank you, Arthur. Next, we have Nadine Block. Nadine has walked hundreds of miles, trained volunteers, built giant puppets, climbed skyscrapers, dangled off bridges, wrangled spoke councils, juggled media, developed curricula, and sailed oceans, all in support of social and economic justice. Her affiliations include work with Bread and Puppet Theater, Greenpeace, Labor Heritage Foundation, Nonviolence International, Ruckus Society, Health Gap, and Housing Works. Nadine's work explores the potent intersection of art and politics, where creative cultural resistance is not only effective political action, but also a powerful way to reclaim agency over our own lives, fight oppressive systems, and invest in our communities, all while having more fun than the other side. So Nadine, thank you for joining us today and being part of this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. And question goes to you. What are three words that capture what you understand nonviolence to be?
Oh, I have to follow up some good ones. I will say resourcefulness and collective or community and beautiful.
All right. Resourcefulness, collective or community, and beautiful. Okay, great. And we are also joined by Kazu Haga. Kazu is founder and coordinator of the East Point Academy, an organization dedicated to bringing about a culture of peace through training, education, and the practice of nonviolence and conflict reconciliation. Grounded in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King, the East Point Academy works with incarcerated populations, youth, activists, and community leaders working to bring about the beloved community. Kazu has been engaged in social change work since he was 17, when he participated in the Interfaith Pilgrimage of the Middle Passage. He now has over 15 years of experience in nonviolence, training and organizing work, and has been trained by civil rights icons and elders such as Dr. Bernard Lafayette and the Reverend James Lawson. Welcome to the show, Kazu, and thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kazu, what are three words that capture what you understand nonviolence to be?
I'm going to keep mine short and sweet and take exactly three words. I would say love and power.
Love and power. Okay, excellent. And lastly, as always, we invite you, our many listeners tuning in from around the world, to chime in with your questions and your comments and to help us guide this conversation and engage with our guests. Our on-air producer, Vanessa Francis, who will be moderating your questions and comments. Vanessa, will you say hello to our friends online?
Hey, everyone. Looking forward to gathering your questions and your comments today.
So when you have a question or a comment, all you need to do is notify Vanessa by clicking the little raise hand button that you will see on your control panel, and Vanessa will get you queued up. She will let you know when you are about to go on air, and then she will unmute you and bring you into the show so you can share your question or comment directly. If you do not have a microphone on your computer, you can also instant message Vanessa by typing your question or comment into the chat box on your control panel, and then Vanessa will read it for you on air. So with that, let's begin. Now, our four guests, all of you bring a unique set of perspectives and experiences to this conversation, and I'm sure you all may define nonviolence in slightly different ways. So I don't want to engage in an intellectual exercise and try and settle on an agreed definition per se, but rather I'd like you to tap into how you as individuals understand nonviolent action. So I want to build off the question that you all responded to in the introduction, those three words that for you capture what you understand nonviolence to be. So explain to us why you chose those three words or those three phrases. Elevi, let's start with you.
Well, my three words, just to recap, love, social responsibility, and interdependence. I chose these words because, you know, many of us know, if not most of us, that human beings sometimes are referred to as, you know, being of animals. Well, when an animal is attacked or hurt or frightened, the first reaction is to hurt back. And somehow, that's how as human beings we have been acting quite often, even though we know that we have not been successful in mitigating the different conflicts that have been separating communities and hurting all of us individually and collectively. So my words, love, social responsibility, and interdependence are very important to me because they are really the background, the basis of my philosophy of as a person. You know, my motto that directs my actions as an educator, as a teacher educator, as a peace educator, most importantly, and as a mentor of youth. I stress that word, mentor. I taught, by the way, I was a teacher in 7th through 12th grades for many, many years, both in Burundi and in the United States. And I learned very, very fast that one of the main reasons why teenagers were difficult to work with, according to my colleagues, is because they did not feel loved. So I decided to realize that I love them. And one time I went to class and I said, you know, I know what you're doing. You think we won't work together, but what if I told you that I actually love you? Mm. From that time on, we never had any problems in class. So I figured that just being the true African mother, you know, I'm an African mother, so we love kids of all ages. I figured that love was an outstanding bridge builder between adults and the youth. And social responsibility, sometimes we think that, no, somebody will resolve this problem. We have an issue here, you know, Darren will figure it out, or Arthur will figure it out. And I realized a long time ago that if this society we live in, that we share, is going to change for the better, each one of us will have to do something positive, that there are no experts in peace building. There are no experts in violence prevention, in conflict prevention. Each one of us have to tap into our natural resources, you know, the power that we have to love, the power to want something that makes us happy and that makes other people happy, and that each one of us have to contribute. Interdependence, we may sometimes focus on differences. Differences sometimes cultural, ethnic, you know, gender orientation, religious. We sometimes portray them as things that divide us, that separate us, and sometimes we think they are the cause of violence. But interdependence for me is very important because if we were to realize that if somebody were not doing something, my life will not be complete, and vice versa, that I, you know, I depend on somebody else's behaviors and actions, and that everything that I do impacts the other and vice versa. And if we were to focus on the fact that every action, every behavior, every belief system that we practice impacts the people around us, we probably would pay more attention and be more capable of working together to advance our quest for nonviolence and peace.
Thank you for that. Alavi. Kazu, what about you? You had love and power.
I did. And when I say love, I'm talking about the Greek word agape. In Greek, they have about five different words for love, and I think it's important that we make the distinctions, because in the English language, you know, we have this one word, love, that people use to reference a lot of different things. So, you know, in English, I can love my girlfriend, I can love my mother, I can love my friends. I can also love a cheeseburger or a great slice of pizza. And it's the same word, but they're very different concepts. And I think because of that, when we talk about love in the context of nonviolence, people oftentimes misunderstand what we're talking about as it being something weak and sentimental and emotional and not, and something devoid of power. Dr. Martin Luther King once said that power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic. And I think oftentimes when we think of concepts like nonviolence and when we think of concepts like love, we forget that love can be an incredibly aggressive and militant force used for resistance. And not just this weak and sentimental kumbaya type of thing that I think oftentimes even Dr. King's own legacy gets watered down to that. And so I think it's really important that we remember that true nonviolence comes when we are able to create movements that are powerful but are grounded in love. You look at a lot of what's happening today in our society, and you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, and it's an incredibly powerful movement that is grounded with the Black leadership that is leading it, and a power and a love for their people. And I think that's what is motivating people into the streets. I think people are incredibly angry about all of the police killings every 28 hours. There's a lot of righteous indignation there that we need to continue to cultivate. But at the end of the day, I think it's important in nonviolent movements that we're constantly reminding ourselves that even that anger, we're angry because we love the people that are being harmed by injustice. And so I think, you know, once you lose sight of that love and you start focusing solely on power, it can become a reckless and abusive force. But once you lose sight of the power and you focus only on the love, then it becomes weak and sentimental and emotional. And so I think it's always important that we remember the true power when you can combine the forces of agape love and people power.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Kazu. Thank you for that. Nadine, you had resourcefulness, collective or community, and beautiful.
I was building off of the love and social responsibility, interdependence, and power that came before. I said resourcefulness. I'll start with that one, because you can also think of violence as resourcelessness. Mm-hmm. In fact, resorting to violence is a very limited approach. You have limited possibility of response physically and emotionally. And I would say resourcefulness in all of its physical and emotional manifestations. So resourcefulness includes all of the emotions of anger and love and greed and jealousy and sadness and hope, and as well as any physical pieces that one would bring, and the struggle that we wage together to build a world that treats everyone in a more healthful and peaceful fashion will take a lot of resourcefulness and a lot of our different abilities and skills and emotions to get there. And so that leads into this word collective. It's I think of nonviolence as people power. That's the power, and we'll talk about this, the power that we wage together. And that's where that word comes from. And beautiful, because I wanted to emphasize the fact that the struggle that we wage with each other, we also end up doing things that are generally adding to the beauty of the world to come. Mm. So I'll leave it there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Nadine. And Arthur, you had a creative force that is accessible and participatory.
Yeah, I really want to talk just about the accessible and participatory part, because I think my colleagues here have done a great job of talking about nonviolence so broadly and so much of what's foundational and underneath it. I think especially in relation to Martin Luther King, one of the drawbacks of how we revere King. And there's so much that was done by Martin Luther King and his leadership that is commendable and offers us such a powerful lesson. But oftentimes we raise him up as so different from ourselves. And Bernard Lafayette, who has done training with both Kazu and I, and we've had a chance to learn from him in developing some of the principles of nonviolence, has the first principle be that nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. And the important piece here, and Elavi mentioned this in relation to expertise, is that this is not to say that people are born courageous, but that together we learn to become courageous. And I think one of the great tragedies inside of a deep culture and mindset of violence is that we see peacemaking as an anomaly, as something that comes out of nowhere. And I know here I'm joined with other peace educators, and this may be resonant with them as well. But I think of peace education and nonviolence education as a really hidden level of movement infrastructure. It's the stuff behind the scenes that does much of the work in bringing people together to think creatively about what's possible. And oftentimes that's not portrayed. Martin Luther King made a point in any meetings where there were nonviolence trainings by Reverend James Lawson and others to come in early, 10 minutes early, and to sit in the front row and in the center to signify that this training work was so important to him. So I think one of the most important things that we need to do on Martin Luther King Day is to find ways to remind each other and to share about the fact that peace education exists, that peace educators are in every community globally, that together we learn how to build these movements and how to apply these principles, that we're not left to do it alone, and that one is not just born a great leader or find themselves in a historical moment, but that it's built, and in some ways really difficultly and slowly, in other ways, as some of the words that were used, beautifully and inspirationally, but it's built, and it's built from the ground up. And we see that, I think, today. We see it in Ferguson with people who've been doing activism work for 30 years, with folks who lived in the community where Mike Brown lived, who have been engaged in community, others who this is their first engagement, national figures all kind of coming together to do the work. That's actually quite a powerful aspect, I think, of movements, is that they're accessible and inclusive in that way, and that we don't, you know, we don't have this just pop up out of nowhere, that the education piece is very much there and one that anyone from whatever background can participate in.
Mm. Well, thank you. Thank you, Arthur. Now, I had you all come up with three words that for you capture what you understand nonviolence to be, and you've provided some really beautiful and insightful kind of perspectives on this. And now I would like to kind of look at some specific examples. So what are two examples from anywhere in the world of what you just described, of this participatory, accessible force, of this type of love and power, of this type of collective community engagement, of this type of interdependence? What are two examples from anywhere in the world of what you just described? In other words, what are two examples of what you consider to be nonviolence? Nadine, let's start with you.
Oh, wow, of course. Well, I'm going to go really old and very new, very current, just because. So a very old example of nonviolent resistance, we could go back to the biblical stories of the Jews who were enslaved in Egypt, and whether or not these are all true, who knows. But the biblical stories are that it was outlawed to have boy children and leave them alive. They were all supposed to be killed. And the midwives of the time thought that was ridiculous, or probably used stronger words. And instead, when male children were born, they were hidden and in some cases brought up in secret. And in some cases, the famous one of Moses, of course, was that he was adopted into the Pharaoh's household, right? So that's an incredible example of risk, an extreme risk that people took to preserve life, a risk of their own lives, and a risk of going against an unjust or immoral law, and from ancient history. And I would say today, you know, working off of what we were just talking about with the Black Lives Matter movement, we see a growing interest in education and encouraging others to participate in the struggle and movement building. In Washington, D.C. here, we had quite a number of actions over the last week, including a teach-in, a training for white allies, a militant nonviolent direct action training, and training of trainers. And so I would just like to say that the whole, in my world of nonviolent action, it includes an emphasis on preparation, training, outreach, and accessibility, and I think as well as being very public in it. So I'll just leave it with those two examples from broadly different places in history.
Great, right. Ancient and contemporary. Arthur, two examples from anywhere in the world of what you just described as being nonviolence.
I think we've seen it. Right now, it's the Black Lives Matter movement has been such a powerful, I think, example of that. And particularly in my experiences when I've been in Ferguson, seeing young people from the community most directly impacted who are in leadership positions. I think it was difficult to imagine in some ways that people would be able to maintain the level of dedication and force considering how intense the repression was. But here we are several hundred days later, and those young people and their allies across the country are still there, not only protesting, but creating communities of care with each other, in reaching out across lines of difference, trying to build systems, community-level systems that support each other in doing conflict resolution work. So I think we see many of these elements there in that broad participation, not only in Ferguson, but as Nadine mentioned, in the folks who are organizing all over the country along those lines. I'm also struck in terms of another U.S. example, and I hope some of my colleagues will talk about some of the international examples because there's been so much inspiration globally as of late in the work that was done in New York State around stopping hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Hard these days to find movements that are able to leverage the power to bring a complete halt to that level of environmentally destructive practices. There are victories that are happening all the time, but it's very difficult considering the preponderance of power and resources, especially that global energy companies have. And although it's a single state in the United States, the fact that fracking was put on a moratorium that was completely due to how people organized and then banned. And when it was banned, the governor of New York State, Mario Cuomo, said, quote, "I couldn't find a person that I talked to in New York State that was supportive of fracking." That speaks to some really long-term, daily, community-based organizing, and it happened for years and years behind the scenes to make that happen.
Great. Thank you, Arthur. Elvi, two examples from anywhere in the world of what you consider to be nonviolence.
I think I would start right around here in everyday classroom in the United States. As an educator, I always learn in the classroom, and because I consider that every classroom where educators are courageous enough to address issues of the discrimination and inequity and injustice to be really non-violence ground in practice, because it's not easy considering that they are teaching against the grain. So any educator in the United States and anywhere else around the world who teaches against the grain is really practicing non-violence. So that's a very broad example. I have, sometimes when we refer to nonviolent movements, we tend to think that only exists when large numbers of people come together to speak and act against the status quo and against injustice. But sometimes it can be a one-person movement before the chance to broaden the group occurs. There is this woman, for instance, in a Burundian village of all places, who, in sharing with me, disclosed that for many years she acted against Tutsi hegemony. She's a Hutu woman, and her nonviolent action consisted in almost partially adopting Hutu children from her elementary school and keeping them at her house in order to tutor them so that they could have a better chance of passing the national exam in sixth grade, because customarily Tutsis were removing the Hutu kids from the rolls of the national exams and declaring that they had all failed. But by, taking that on, she increased at least the chances that at least a few of those would be able to successfully complete that exam and access secondary education, which was a big breakthrough for many of the children. And then, of course, my other example that includes, a group of women in Nigeria, where in the Delta, when they protested against the oil companies and their unjust practices and that were destroying the people and the environment. And then the women got together and basically stripped. Instead of taking guns and machetes, they did that nonviolently, because in the African culture, it's a big message, a major, major insult for a woman to purposefully drop her clothes, because that really communicates that no one has any respect for you, in that community. And they were actually able to get oil, the Shell Oil Company, to change its practices and to enter into negotiations with the local communities and find equitable solutions to their practices.
Wonderful examples, Elavi, and I think also you and others who've spoken so far are really helping us break out of this idea that nonviolent movements or campaigns are masses of people in the streets. That's one aspect of it, but there are so many other examples that you all have touched on so far. Kazu, let's go to you now. Two examples from anywhere in the world of what you consider to be nonviolence.
Yeah, I'm also going to dig into our history a little bit and share one contemporary piece, not as far back as Nadine's, but one of my mentors, David Hartzell, who recently came out with a book called Waging Peace, he's been arrested 129 times or something throughout his life doing civil disobedience, and he was a participant in the student lunch counter sit-in movement in the early 1960s, and he tells a story of when he was sitting in the lunch counter one day, and he turns around and there was a man who had a knife right in his throat. And this man says, he said, N-word lover, you have 3 seconds to get up out of this lunch counter or I will shove this knife down your throat. And David says he turned around and he stood up and he looked his assailant right in the eye. And he says, brother, you do what you have to do, but my job is to love you regardless. And he says that the man with the knife started, like, you could just see the tears welling up in his eyes, and he turned around and walked away. And I think that's one small example of that sort of love and power, because that was an incredibly powerful response that he had. And I think so much of nonviolence is about using the power of love to try to reach the best part of human beings. And, it also speaks to what Nadine was talking about in terms of preparation, though, because if he wasn't prepared for that moment and if he hadn't been trained in nonviolence, I think it's very difficult for people to respond nonviolently to violent conflicts like that. But to me, that's one of my favorite stories about the strength of nonviolence. And I'm also thinking about a campaign that I've been directly involved in. There's a high school in Chicago called North Lawndale College Prep. And coincidentally, this high school is about a mile away from where Dr. King used to live when he was organizing in Chicago. And it's a neighborhood that still struggles with incredible levels of violence and poverty. And I was doing a week-long nonviolence training there for a group of students there years ago, about 4 years ago, 3 years ago. And in the middle of the training, we get a phone call that one of the students, her best friend, was just shot and was in the hospital. So we paused the training and we circled and we were singing songs. And the teacher at that school was saying how even in neighborhoods in Chicago, there are neighborhoods where kids don't get shot every day, that the level of violence that those students witness is not normal. When another young girl, a sophomore at the time, stood up and she started challenging us. And she said, "What? That's not true. This is how it is everywhere." And it kind of hit me, and it hit all of us at the time, that for this young girl, that level of violence is all she had ever known her entire life, that she couldn't even comprehend that there were neighborhoods where that wasn't the norm. And I share the story because it ends on a happy note. This young girl is now one of the student peace warriors at North Lawndale College Prep, and this is a school that invested in its young people and completely changed the culture of that school, and it had led to a 70% reduction in violence in the first year of programming and a 90% reduction in the 4 years following, and they're still maintaining that. And I think it's amazing that by investing in the young people, in the student population, that they've been able to create such a culture of peace and a beloved community there. Mm.
Kazu, is there something that people can put into their Google search window to learn more about that school and that example?
Yeah, if you Google North Lawndale College Prep and peace, I'm sure things will come up. If you also Google Chicago's Peace Warriors, an article that I wrote a few years ago might come up as well.
Okay, great. Now, you all have shared three words. You've shared two examples. And now I'm going to ask you to share one misconception. One misconception that you all feel people have about nonviolence that you would like to address or correct. And I think you've touched on maybe some of those a little bit. But just tell us one misconception that you feel you come across time and time again when you're talking about, teaching about, et cetera, about nonviolence. Arthur, let's start with you. What's one misconception you feel people have about nonviolence?
I think it's that it can't be taught. What I find is that oftentimes when people have not had an opportunity to think with others around the possibilities of how to respond to really difficult circumstances in nonviolent ways, that an absence of knowing what those possibilities are, oftentimes they're more inclined to say that violence would be a helpful solution, that seeing violence as a helpful solution decreases as people become more and more aware of the alternatives and possibilities. And once that, I would say once that frame is opened up, that people are looking at it through a lens of nonviolence and creative responses, it's always the case that they have plenty of examples from their own life, from their community, of examples where people have creatively responded. So I think one of the biggest kind of misnomers is that nonviolence is for certain kinds of people, that it's sort of innate. For just a very rare group of people, a sort of like, you know, the idea that maybe Gandhi was sort of born with the loincloth and the walking stick, and you know, with this ability and desire to not harm any living thing, and back to that point where in fact it can be taught, and every kind of great leader, as well as all the many thousands of people whose names we don't know, underwent a process of increasing their skills, deepening their knowledge, and practicing with other people.
Mm-hmm. Elvi, what about you? What's one misconception that you feel people have about nonviolence?
Now I'm there. One misconception is that nonviolence is passive, that people engage in it because, you know, they know they can't win, they don't have enough weapons, that they have no way to fight back, therefore they fall back on nonviolence practices.
Excellent. Kazu, what about you? What's a misconception that you've come across?
I think one of the biggest is the idea that nonviolence is the same as not being violent, that a lot of people think as long as I'm not being violent, then I'm being nonviolent. And I oftentimes tell a story of a fight that was going on outside of my own house a couple of years ago, where there was a woman on the ground who was getting beat, and she was crying and she was screaming for someone to come help her. And so I live on the second floor. I saw this happening outside of my window. I ran downstairs. I ran out the gate. And by that time, this fight had spilled over onto the other side of the street. So I ran across the street and broke up this fight. And meanwhile, about 15 of my neighbors had gathered, and they were just watching this woman get beat. And I would say that all of my neighbors who were just standing there watching this woman get beat were not being violent. Right? They weren't the ones throwing the punches and the kicks, and they weren't perpetuating the violence. But for us, when we talk about nonviolence, it's not about not being violent. It's not about what you don't do in the face of violence, but it's about when you see violence and when you see injustice in your community, what are you going to do about it, and how are you going to engage in that struggle, and how are you going to take a stand against violence? I think there's a world of difference between being nonviolent and simply not being violent.
This is a good distinction. Nadine, what about you, a misconception that you feel people have about nonviolence?
I'm going to go back to this passive piece, I think. I was just this weekend, we did a training in Washington, D.C. that we had to call militant nonviolent direct action. And for me, that is redundant. All nonviolent direct action is what I would consider disciplined, courageous, aggressive, or assertive, if you want to use that word. Depends on a historical record, implies that you've been trained in what some might consider a militant or a disciplined fashion. And I think that, so it's not only a confusion about whether or not passivity, doing nothing, equates with a pacifist. I think there's that confusion about the word passivity and pacifist, but also today's new initiates to nonviolent direct action don't understand the difference between a philosophical bent and a strategic use of nonviolent activism. And that's why we had to, and why I agreed with the description of a militant nonviolent direct action training, to imply that it would be, that it involves courage, that it involves commitment, that it involves being willing to practice and train in it. And that there is a historical record that one can learn about.
Mm-hmm. We have a question or a comment from one of our listeners.
Yep. We have a question from Amani. Question is, I'm interested in knowing how to improve the skills of nonviolence for youth, or how we can plant the idea when we train them or deal with them, because speaking about stories or history of nonviolence sometimes can seem boring to youth.
Mm-hmm. So moving beyond just the stories, the anecdotes, the examples, but what are the specific knowledge and skills that can be taught, that can be trained in order to make people wage conflict using nonviolence? Kazu, can we start with you on that? What are the specific knowledge and skills that you feel are necessary for a conflict to be waged nonviolently?
Well, I think, you know, every young person, every child is already very familiar with conflict, right? Conflict is something that we all experience. And I think part of what we teach in our trainings is the idea that conflict is not a bad thing. Conflict itself is completely neutral. And we oftentimes associate conflict with things like yelling and arguing and fighting, but those things aren't conflicts. They're things that happen when you mismanage a conflict. And so a lot of the trainings that we do is, including with young people, is about identifying conflict and really understanding the nature of it and learning to respond to it in ways that, instead of ending in yelling and arguing, ends in a lesson learned or a strengthened relationship. And a lot of that happens through role plays. A lot of that happens by analyzing the conflicts that they've been through just in their lives that day. And also just trying to figure out, just trying to have real conversations about the larger social conflicts that they're dealing with every day, whether it's violence in the community or violence from the state and the police department, and just figuring out effective ways to deal with those on a larger structural level.
Mm-hmm. Arthur, what do you think are some of the specific knowledge skills of nonviolence?
I think, you know, there's a few different levels that come to mind right away. There's skills, and Kazu talked about the theater piece or the role plays, and I know that Nadine does a lot of this work too, where we can, on an interpersonal level or on a community level, have create situations of real conflict that are happening in the community. and have opportunities to try to intervene and try to shift that dynamic. So there we take stories that are happening right now. So, you know, the old stories, the listener said, you know, the old stories can sometimes be boring. And we can work with the stories right now to think about how in that same situation we might respond differently. Augusto Boal, who created this body of work, Theater of the Oppressed, called that kind of work, and listeners will find a lot on Augusto Boal online, that way of responding, rehearsal for life, where we are rehearsing different ways of interacting when there's really difficult situations. In the Kingian nonviolence, there's six principles of nonviolence. So principles are not exactly like skills, but they're a kind of a mental skill in how we orient ourselves and how we think about something. So like that, the example of that principle I mentioned before, nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. The principle doesn't tell you what to do. And similarly, even when you're doing role plays and you're experimenting, there's, you know, the response is always going to be dependent on what's going on in the moment. So a lot of this is the practice piece, so you can feel it in your body, so you can practice coordinating and working with others, like when you're doing direct action training. And also is this piece around the analysis. So in other words, we couldn't have just like a nonviolence robot that had these formulas and algorithms of these skills and we could just feed it a situation and it would just automatically know how to respond. That analysis and how we see creative possibility is going to be really important. So just one piece, and maybe this is me as an academic in defense of the boring old stories, those stories then provide some of the foundations that should, I think they become boring when we don't ask the question, well, what does that have to do with today? So if we think about Gandhi's spinning wheel, Gandhi wasn't doing this, asking people across India to spin their own clothing because he thought it was cool and hip to wear organic threads and it would get him credibility in his community or he'd save a few bucks. Gandhi said it was the sound of a million spinning wheels that would send, it would be the sweet music of a million spinning wheels that would send the British home. He knew that if people were doing it at the village level across India, that it would break the back of the British industrial grip on that form of production. And so I think the way we make that story not boring is we turn to ourselves today at a time where, you know, we're facing huge ecological crisis or we're facing degradation of entire groups of people, and we ask, what is the spinning wheel for today? What's the thing that a million people or 10 million people can do right out of their home, that if they do it in unison, will have the political power to make people listen or to alter the political landscape? I think that's how we keep it from being boring, is we have to ask the question when we tell the story, well, what can we learn about that for today?
Mm-hmm. Spinning wheel, I like that. Nadine, what about you? The specific knowledge and skills that you have found kind of integral in the trainings that you've conducted and facilitated?
So like LV, I work in somewhat traditional settings and non-traditional settings with youth as young as third grade, which in the United States, that's 8 years old, all the way up to people who are 80, still young at heart. And I work locally with a group called the Young Activist Club. In just a moment about them, their group of kids that came together who wanted to do something about climate, but wanted to make it relevant to their own life. As Arthur said, so the work that they decided to do is about getting rid of polystyrene, toxic styrofoam trays in their schools, because not only was it bad for the climate, it was bad for their health. And I would report that they've had success banning the styrofoam trays in Tacoma Park, and we just banned it in Montgomery County, and those of you in the District of Columbia know we banned it in the district, and New York also banned it very recently, and of course the West Coast is ahead of us. But all that is to say that they respond really specifically to making it like anyone, really, you know, what's in it for me? How does it relate to my real life? There are specific tools around getting a group to function better that are particularly useful, generating group agreements within the group that you work with, from the group, of the group, and for the group, doing exercises that help them understand themselves, self-knowledge, you know, and how that affects the group's functioning. As was mentioned, it's an art, not a science. But stories of where things work effective, storytelling is if you're a good storyteller, it is extraordinarily effective for people. And getting the kids to tell their own stories and share stories about other youth is really effective. I personally do love interactive things. I very rarely have people sitting down in the situations where I find myself facilitating. So updated role plays like short half a line exercises or stop action role plays where you run things for a very brief amount of time, because in reality, the youth today have really short attention spans, even shorter attention spans than we had when I was a youth, I know, for because of the devices. And if you can harness the devices in some of this work, do online games, utilize social media in posting things or transmitting information rather than excluding it from the work that we do, it actually broadens the impact in the young circles that we work in. Mm-hmm. So I'll stop there.
And Elvie, what about you? What do you consider to be some of the key knowledge and skills of nonviolence?
Well, this is particularly in the African Burundian context, where for the past several years I have been trying to work with youth. I noticed that one of the most important pieces of knowledge they need and lack often is the knowledge of alternatives to violence. When youth and when people don't have any knowledge of alternatives for addressing issues in their communities, there is nothing they can do. So, and this is a serious thing, because we cannot assume that everybody knows. Well, instead of picking up a machete, which may cause this, you know, additional problems, maybe I can do this. They need to know alternatives. Skills that I also have realized we need to work on more, it's actually the simple collaboration, working together to achieve the same goal. And we know that even here in the United States, we are often challenged by our tendency to look out for more individual visibility and so forth. So accepting and really investing themselves and ourselves to work together in the pursuit of a common goal non-violently. Mm-hmm. Another skill that I think is critical is what I call discipline of the mind and of the body. Now, that I think that's a challenge as well. Communication, we cannot emphasize that enough. We cannot be, and the youth we work with and the people we work with cannot really be effective non-violent people without strong communication skills. And finally, critical reflection. And this is something that has almost complicated my work in Burundi when I realized, oh my goodness, they cannot reflect. So they can't link, they can't question, you know, why and what if. And it's through asking this what if and how come that people can actually create these alternatives. So, yeah, that's what I have.
Great. Thank you, Elvie. And I want to bring up a question, because I know one of our guests, Arthur, has to run to class. Arthur, are you still there? I think he was actually running as he was responding to the last question. Are you still here, Arthur?
Yes.
Do you have time for one more question?
Yes, I do.
Okay. The question that I wanted to bring up to you, and I wanted to kind of, again, put this question out there before you had to go to class, is connecting this back to Martin Luther King Jr. Because like we said at the beginning of the show, here in the United States, we celebrated Martin Luther King Day. And many of you have alluded to the fact that the story and history of Martin Luther King is in many ways watered down, I think was a term that somebody used, or incorrect in some circumstances. So the question I want to ask is, since we're coming off the heels of MLK Day, let's turn to King's life and legacy of nonviolent direct action. What elements of Dr. King's life or work or understanding of nonviolence do you think has been misunderstood or underappreciated or forgotten? And Arthur, let's start with you.
One thing that comes to mind is there's been a way in which the incredible challenges that he and other people faced in the movement, how deep and violent they were, has been somewhat whitewashed. The class I'm about to go teach is on conflict resolution, and I think what nonviolence does from a conflict resolution point of view is it constructively escalates the conflict. The number one charge that King was arrested on was disturbing the peace. Peace misunderstood as the status quo where things are unjust. And so oftentimes King is framed as this sort of moderate person who had this dream. In fact, when when he delivered that I Have a Dream speech, in the lead up to that, if you watch the Meet the Press interview with him, they ask him on a number of occasions if he thinks there's going to be widespread violence as a result of these marches. People were fearful of large numbers of African American people coming to the nation's capital. They were fearful of the economic changes that King and others were advocating for. They were fearful of this call to end the repression in Vietnam. King called that a demonic suction tube that rips away resources from the poor. Where King and Rosa Parks and many other activists spent time in their training and discussions, the Highlander Center in Tennessee, which is still doing great work, was burned to the ground, called a communist training camp. So King was far from a defender of the status quo in that way. And I think in some ways, ironically, when people see the kind of resistance and work that's taking place where people are saying in Ferguson and elsewhere that this is not okay, and we will shut down the malls, and we will shut down the city, and we'll do whatever we need to do to create an opportunity for us to have a real discussion about what it's going to take to create a humane society for everyone, and where people have an opportunity, that I think people, because of this sort of whitewashing of the history, oftentimes are unable to make that connection. People feel uncomfortable. And I think Martin Luther King's work made people feel uncomfortable, and as well as the many women and men who were behind the scenes, because they in so many ways challenged that. They took what was underneath the rug, what was unspoken, in much of white and affluent communities in the United States, and they made it visible. And they didn't make it visible for a day or for a week. They made it visible, in the case of the Montgomery bus boycotts, every day for over a year. And so I think in this way, it's kind of clear to see the young people in Ferguson in direct lineage, because now we're getting to a point where it's several hundred days that they've been making sacrifices so that people can see. So I think that if anything I would say in terms of misunderstanding of King, it's this idea that he was this kind of palatable, kind of easygoing figure who did not challenge the status quo. I think the incredible repression and violence that he and others experienced was a sign that stuff was being shooken up, and that things that we didn't want to look at, we were being forced to look at. And I think that is what activists in the Black Lives Matter movement and other movements today are doing. I think King very consciously pushed the issue in a way that was highly, profoundly uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, Arthur, I know you've got to go to class, but thank you for your valuable insights in today's show. Have a good class. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be with this group of people. Thank you all.
And I'm going to hold on to hopefully Nadine, Elevi, and Kazu for about 15 more minutes. And I'll just remind folks that you're listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from around the world to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. And on today's special episode of the Peace Frequency, we are looking at nonviolence, the role that is playing in today's conflicts, the knowledge and skills that groups and individuals must have in order to wage nonviolent action successfully. I want to have our other guests address this issue of MLK's history and legacy, and what are some things that are maybe underappreciated or forgotten or misunderstood about that legacy. Nadine, you have any thoughts on that?
Gosh, I think Arthur did a great job talking about MLK in specific, and I do think it's this general problem. We see it with Martin Luther King, we see it with Rosa Parks. We're really talking about the whitewash word is so appropriate because it is part of a systemic pattern of violence from in an oppressive regime, if you will. And so to make these heroes look as if they're not challenging an entire system that is unjust, and because that's very threatening to the powers that be. And I think not only is that the case, but in the situation, we can go back to something that I can't remember who said it earlier, maybe it was Kazu, but the idea that people need to be able to believe that they themselves can join in a nonviolent resistance, that they don't have to be born with the skills and talents and groups to go forward with in order for us to continue growing our numbers, which is the backbone of people power. And when you put out that, all of a sudden one day Rosa Parks was just tired, and you don't tell her history about her being active in the NAACP for years and having been through training at the Highlander Center, which was mentioned before, and that she was, the fifth person to try this technique, and on, and the support network that was put into place. So when we talk about MLK as if, he was always the leader that he is now remembered for being, or we do a great disservice to those people who would join the movement if they had support or connections or training to actively learn about, as Elvie says, alternatives and reflection and the importance of getting support in different ways. So I think I'll stop there, because it's just, it is really important that we reclaim our people's history in the full breadth of it. And as they say, those who write the history are going to determine what we remember. And so it's really important that as we take to the streets, even now, we make sure to put out and share effective tactics and tools. So I really do thank you for convening this conference call and the courses that you offer at USIP.
Great. Thanks, Nadine. Elvie, your reflections on MLK's life and legacy and elements of it that have been misunderstood, underappreciated, or too often forgotten?
Yeah, I think what always hits me every time I read more and watch more movies about his work, I always think that the personal sacrifices that his family had to endure, sometimes tend to be underappreciated, if not forgotten. In other words, he really had to, manage conflicts outside and inside. Sometimes almost he had no break. It was really, really very difficult work. Another thing that's often misunderstood is the fact that not all, for whatever reasons, not all African Americans were behind him. Mm-hmm. Some of them probably because of fear of retribution, others for, whatever reasons may not be known, or because they did not agree with his approach. And sometimes, idealistically, we like to think that, he was the voice of all African Americans, and I don't think he was.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Kazu, your thoughts?
Yeah, I love the call that came out of the Ferguson activists this year about reclaiming the legacy of Martin Luther King, because I think and others have already spoken to it, the militancy of Dr. King and the radicalness of his message is sometimes forgotten, that, peace is a very, very messy process. And the efforts to organize for justice is an incredibly messy, uncomfortable, tense process. And we forget that, you know, Dr. King called the United States government the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And it's interesting that he becomes this icon that the U.S. government uses now to talk about how we're the beacon of freedom and all these things. But the reality is when Dr. King was shot, he was considered an enemy of the state in so many ways. And he was the last campaign that he was working on, the Poor People's Campaign, they were trying to use mass civil disobedience to shut down the entire city of Washington, D.C. And Dr. King talked about how we have a responsibility of breaking unjust laws. And I think, I've been reading a lot the letter from a Birmingham jail, which in this day and age, it's such a timely document. And I really encourage everyone to read the letter from a Birmingham jail, which was a response to a short public statement from a clergyman in Birmingham. And a lot of the criticisms that those clergymen said to King it's the same criticisms that especially the Black Lives Matters movement is getting today. And I think his responses to those criticisms are so timely for us to look at. And, you know, we just forget how militant he was. But, you know, I also want to mention one other thing kind of on the flip side of that is, you know, because Dr. King's image is so sanitized, it goes the other way too, because King also wasn't perfect, right? For example, he was not a great family man. And I think it's important to acknowledge his faults also, because as others have said, we think of King as someone who is so distant from us, so we could never practice nonviolence because we're not Dr. King. But Dr. King was also very human, and he made a lot of mistakes also, as did Gandhi, as did all these great leaders. So it's also important, as his image is sanitized, that, you know, we remember that he was also human.
That's very useful. Thanks for that, Kazu. So we have a question actually from one of our listeners.
Our listener writes, thank you very much for your examples and useful insights. Bringing old and new stories about nonviolent social movements helps very much to understand what can be learned and used in other movements. But my question is about movements that happen in conflict zones where nonviolent activists and movements are under great risk and suppressed, as we can see globally now in Libya, Syria, etc. How can these movements last and continue under the threats of armed violence?
This is a great and challenging question, and it goes to this: what is the role of nonviolence in today's conflicts? I mean, like our listener said, our newspapers are talking about Syria, talking about Libya, talking about you name it, where very violent things are happening to folks. So, what role does nonviolence play in these types of conflicts where people face grave violent repression? Elevi, can we start with you?
Yeah, and last year I had the privilege of participating with a group of African non-violent, supporters and practitioners, and the workshop in South Africa was led by members of the ICNC. Most of the participants came from context of armed conflict. And repeatedly they stated that all the things that Professor Zunes was sharing could not really be practiced because of the danger that the nonviolence group would be facing. So, and that's a major challenge. But I'm thinking, for instance, about the work that could be a little bit more indirect, like the work I have been trying to engage youth in Burundi, which is a place where, you know, people still really don't have a voice. Practicing the kind of non-violence that looks a little bit less threatening to the armed groups. Mm-hmm. So the youth in Burundi, under my mentoring, have been engaging in community service as one strategy to counter the mounting pressure to take up arms. And then other groups from schools and on, you know, outside of schools have been preparing and hosting peace concerts and cultural events where they sensitize their fellow youth and the communities around them who participate in those events and kind of increase their consciousness about the importance of acting non-violently and supporting, you know, the efforts to live together in peace. And those are examples of non-violent actions that are not threatening to the armed groups and yet are powerful in reducing the temptations from other youth and community members to take up arms. So I agree that there is a challenge, but in, you know, so that's why I'm looking for to begin with and continue with actions that are a little bit less threatening. Because if Burundi, if a group of youth or people were to walk to the Supreme Court, for instance, and demand changes, I don't think it would go well. For now.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
So, there is a big difference. In the West, when people practice nonviolence and do sit-ins and marches and so forth, and they are arrested and sent to jail, sometimes they are lucky they get out of jail. In some of these conflict-ridden armed conflicts, sometimes when you go to jail, you don't get out. Alive. So those are some of the things, cross-cultural, cross-community issues that we have to consider and be more creative to come up with actions that beginning actions that are less threatening and yet be able to grow the nonviolent movement.
Nadine, what about you? And we only have about 2 minutes left, but Nadine, your thoughts on what role does nonviolence play in today's conflicts, particularly those that where individuals face extreme forms of violence?
So I think I spend a lot of my time these days doing work in what I call creative conflict resolution or creative cultural activism. And so I'm seconding what Elvie said. I think the creativity that's possible within the nonviolent spectrum, the resourcefulness, is exactly what is called for. So there has nonviolent direct action is not only what you identify publicly as a protest or a blockade, but if you do your strategic planning effectively, then yep. It might be something like a slowdown or, you know, what happened to Casero Lazos from Chile that have then been used successfully in Turkey or in the Quebec student movement. Or we can talk about the fact that you may strategically choose to build your group and to build your organizational structure, waiting for the moment when you are not putting everyone at risk for, you know, annihilation and destroying your movement. So, you know, this part of the work of incorporating creative resistance at appropriate times demands training and preparation and strategic planning. I would suggest that, you know, I mean, people could look at some of the fabulous information that's out there. This, you know, the work that happened in resisting the Soviet Union, like The Singing Revolution is a great movie, or Bringing Down a Dictator, talking about Otpor and some of the creative pieces of work that they did. Of course, there's just so much that's out there. And I think, as was suggested maybe earlier, a Google search of some of this would be great. And if people want, also the Beautiful Trouble website, beautifultrouble.org, is a collection of these more creative and in stories that could potentially help to be strategic about the breadth of resistance that would help to keep your people safe and respond appropriately to domestic threats or international threats, but internal threats.
Thank you, Nadine. And Kazu, you'll have the last word on this. What role does nonviolence play in today's conflicts, particularly those where people face extreme forms of repression?
I'll try to be quick. I think sometimes nonviolence is held up against this impossible double standard where, you know, people say, well, nonviolence isn't going to work against this regime because if you resist nonviolently, they'll kill you. And that kind of assumes that if you resist violently, that they won't kill you. Right? Like, if you're resisting against a violent regime, chances are you're going to face state violence anyways. So then the question becomes, what's more effective? And I think if you look at the work of Erica Chenoweth, the research has actually shown that nonviolent movements, even against violent regimes, are twice as effective than violent regimes. And I would also just add that I think part of the strength of nonviolent movements is that there's an old saying that hating someone is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. And I think when you engage in violent conflicts where people become the enemy, it's really easy to begin to internalize that violence and to bring that home into your own communities. You see it in the soldier suicides, that there's more U.S. soldiers that are committing suicide now than are getting killed overseas because that violence becomes internalized. And I think part of the power of nonviolence is being able to wage struggles and wage revolutions without starting to see people and human beings as the enemy. So I think that's an important piece of nonviolent conflict.
That's great. Thank you, Kazu, Nadine, Elavi, and Arthur, who left us a little earlier, for being on the show today. This has been an absolutely fascinating and valuable conversation. A couple final kind of points and announcements. A couple resources and organizations were shared during this podcast, and we're going to do our best to share those through our USIP Global Campus Facebook page. The first is Elavi referenced ICNC, which stands for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict, a wonderful organization that advances the study and practice of nonviolent action or civil resistance. So we'll post information about ICNC in the Facebook group. And actually, they are going to be holding their annual Fletcher Summer Institute for the Advanced Study of Nonviolent Conflict, and they are accepting applications now. So again, we'll post information about how you can apply to that wonderful program. Also, Kazu mentioned Letter from a Birmingham Jail, just a wonderful piece of writing by Dr. King. And Stanford University actually has collections of King's work. And I recently came up upon a recording of Dr. King actually reading Letter from a Birmingham Jail. And reading it just on your own is a powerful experience. Listening to him read it is even more powerful. So we'll post that in as well. And then Nadine mentioned Beautiful Trouble, which is an amazing book, amazing resource with case studies, examples, tactics, and skills. And a lot of learning and workshops have been born out of that collective work. So we will share information about Beautiful Trouble as well. And then lastly, Kazu mentioned this wonderful work by Dr. Erica Chenoweth and Dr. Maria Stefan in their book, Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict, where they did a multi-year quantitative study comparing the success rates of violent and nonviolent campaigns. And as Kazu mentioned, what they found was that nonviolent movements were twice as likely to succeed when compared to violent movements. Violent movements were successful 26% of the time. Nonviolent movements were successful 53% of the time. So they don't always win, but they're much more likely to succeed. And this is the kind of information that our guests and others working on nonviolent action are trying to get out there to the world, because there's a rich history. You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a weekly podcast series that brings together scholars, practitioners, activists, and learners from around the world to discuss and debate the important work of building peace in our time. This has been a special episode looking at nonviolent action. Our guests have been Arthur Romano, Elavi Andura, Nadine Block, and Kazu Haga. And we thank all of our listeners who chimed in with their questions and comments. I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. My co-host for this month of the podcast has been Dr. Allison Miloski. Our producers are Leah Cullins, Vanessa Francis. Our theme music is composed by Blake Mobley, and our graphic designer is Manuel Leon. It's been wonderful having you on the show, and we look forward to hearing from you next week.